Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. For those of you in cold, wintry climates, hopefully you have shoveled out. Wade is on his fourth shoveling of the morning. It's not even lunchtime for Wade, and he's already been out shoveling three times. He's snowblown, and he's already put another log on the fire. So for those of you in cold climates, hopefully this cold snap will be gone. So today, Wade, I got you, as always, assistant special agent in charge of the LA field office and now a manager on our SIU investigative team, and Matt Kachansky, retired special agent in charge at HHS OIG, the retired Northeast UPIC director, and our payment integrity director. Matt, you can't leave to another job because your resume has, there's no more room.
There's no more room. There's no more. Making the type smaller.
You just have the smaller font each time. Yeah. So today we want to talk about, kind of an interesting premise, which is from the provider side, but how it implicates the SIUs is when an unintentional error by a provider, and it does happen, becomes an investigation. And we're going to be very generic about investigations because they could be civil, criminal, administrative, but even an internal investigation when the provider's doing whatever they're doing. And obviously, the first piece of this is that the way that you help to prevent unintentional errors. Now, we want to be very specific. We're not really talking about providers that are intent on committing the F word, fraud, because people that are committing fraud, there's intent. And we're going to talk in a minute about errors versus intent. But people who are intending to steal from healthcare plans, Medicare, Medicaid, commercial, whatever it may be, they don't care about the rules. So we're not really talking about that. We're talking about instances where it's a waste, abuse, ignorance, willful or not, we'll call it willful ignorance, but willfully blind, or something along those lines where the provider just didn't have the proper means in place, right? So the way that you help to stave off a lot of these unintentional errors is through a robust internal auditing process following the OIG's 7-point model compliance, which includes self-audit. And as we like to say, the fox shouldn't watch the hen house. People that do these audits should be a third party, neutral. We do a ton of these where you don't really have an opinion one way or another. It's what's right and wrong and getting them done. So, it's internal audits. It's identifying the overpayments. It's making sure that your internal auditing is complete and accurate. You can't just look at the four corners of a paper and look at what has been previously coded. You've got to look at 360 degrees of the document. And you also have to look at any associated documents so that if there is an audit or an investigational review or an investigation, that you've got all of the documents that you're going to send off. And then finally, education and training internally to educate and train providers on where they've had some areas, both for missed opportunities. Did you not bill for something that you could have billed? Did you not document something as thoroughly as you could have documented to create that revenue stream, as well as where were your weaknesses and areas where you are going to run into a problem and potentially run into an overpayment? So Wade, I want to start with you because there's going to be a huge difference between an error and something that is done intentionally. Right. So, let's talk about some examples of where something is intentionally done. And I think it's always intentionally, while it has the highest threshold, if we're talking intent, we're talking typically about someone committing fraud. And in those cases, it is more likely than not the standard is going to be the intent. How do you prove that intent? And although as an SIU investigator, you're not there to prove intent, it is that is left up to law enforcement to articulate. But, part of it is being able to demonstrate that this provider has a pattern or practice of doing something. So let's talk about what are some of the signs and symptoms of intent versus an error.
Right. Well, and not to repeat what you said, but just to kind of set it up. As always, it seems like half the times we're doing these podcasts, it comes back to intent. And this, of course, when we're talking about unintentional, intent is part of that, as you just said. And it does go from intentional conduct, which, like you said, for criminal cases, and then it kind of on a continuum of like egregiousness or like a sliding scale, you have things like recklessness, negligence, and then the non-intentional, unintentional, or errors. And again, that determines what type of investigation it's going to be, from criminal, civil, administrative, down to just an educational letter going out, probably at the low end of things. But the other thing to look at is when was it determined to be non-intentional? Was it in the triage stage? Is it early in the investigation, midway through the investigation? That's going to determine kind of the track that this takes. If it's determined early on in like triage that this was unintentional, it was a mistake, and there's no fraud element to it, that can be handled by like a quality assurance risk management part of the, you know, company. It doesn't necessarily have to go to the SIU. And in that stage, they're going to be looking for the errors and the underlying causes. You know, the key thing there is to, you know, determine if there's any deliberate intent, which if there's not, then again, we go to the risk management. But what you're looking for is really, is this systematic or is it a one-off? Like, is there something that we can train for to, you know, stop this, you know, unintentional behavior that's causing probably, you know, technically false claims. There's a bunch of different like examples of what this could be. I think Matt's going to talk about a lot of those, but some of them, just a couple that come to mind, you know, possibly like mislabeling lab samples is one of them. But a lot of it really comes down to, you know, inadequate training could lead to a lot of things like improper coding, things of that nature, but I won't go too much into examples. But again, what you want to do in the investigation is figure out the root cause kind of analysis. Is it a systematic issue or is it a one-off? And then kind of assign training as appropriate. If you can correct that
right.
In the big picture, that makes a big difference.
Root cause analysis works both ways. You know, right. If you have on the provider side, you're constantly getting denials for services that you believe should be covered, and you're getting denied on that. You know, what is the root cause of why you're getting denial? What is the payer saying is the reason? Is there some technical violation? Are they putting you on a prepay? Are they doing a review? You know, why do you keep getting a particular thing denied if you think it should be paid? Is it something where you needed, for example, a prior authorization? And the thing that the payers love to talk about is, right, prior authorization is not a guarantee of payment. It's a guarantee that there is a coverage available. It's not a promise of payment. It's a understanding that there is coverage available for that. So it does work on the provider side to make sure you've got all those ducks in a row, but also that risk management piece and that one-off and that pattern of practice is also something on the payer side to understand, hey, is this just one provider who's billing for this weird thing? Or are there other providers? Is there confusion about a policy? Is there a lack of policy? Right. Is there inconsistent guidance for that, right? So those are all things that from an investigator's perspective, again, it gets back to what is the prevailing guidance that the payer is going to have to follow? And in a little bit of it to an extent is that guidance been properly communicated to the right. provider, right? Because if guidance has not been properly communicated to the provider, and by the way, you have to be able to demonstrate that the provider that has been communicated properly to the provider, whether it be through proving that they've received an email or something like that, but you have to be able to show kind of all those pieces of the puzzle.
Yeah. And there's like two elements of that too. Not only is giving them proper education going to help prevent the behavior from, or the, you know, the billing, whatever the issue is, from reoccurring, it also puts them on notice. And then your letter to them where you might write them and say, you know, we've determined this to be, you know, the wording is special on that, but you know, it's either, even though we consider this unintentional, the overpayment resulted in X amount of dollars, please pay this amount. Or it could be the other way too. It was unintentional, and because of that, we owe you money. Maybe you billed it for a lesser amount than you could have been billing. So in that case, in the big scheme of pictures, we owe them money. But the other important part of that is now they've been put on notice that they've been doing it wrong. So if it comes back, you know, 6 months, a year later, and they're still doing the same thing, now we have that educational piece. Like you said, we can show that we faxed this letter and it says you're doing it wrong. This is the way you should be doing it. And you continue to do it that way. And of course, that's only going to happen if they're making more money than they should. It's not if we're refunding money, but they've been put on notice that they're doing it wrong. So now if it happens again, they can't say, Oh, I didn't know. And it's, you know, the unintentional or what's the legal term I'm looking for?
Can't think it was just of, a but, mistake of fact or something along those lines. But right,
they just didn't know any better. Yeah. We've showed that you do. We've educated you, so you should have known better, basically.
Right. Some sort of like reckless disregard. Or
that's
something.
What I'm trying to think of. Yeah. Reckless disregard.
Well, you know, but in that same vein, you know, what we're seeing in the provider space too, or the payer space, is a lot of times payers are kind of sending a first shot across the bow, sending a letter to the provider saying, hey, FYI, you're becoming an outlier for this code. Knock it off, whether you take that as good, bad, or indifferent, but hey, we're letting you know that you're an outlier. Now, you know, what I always tout on the provider side is if you got a letter like that, it shouldn't be a revelation. Right. If you're a provider, you should know your billings. You should know your data. You should know that your billings for a particular item, service, or procedure are higher than they were at some other time. When you get that letter, you should be prepared to just know, okay, I already know that. Of course, I'm an outlier, and here's why I'm an outlier, and just be prepared, because the next step is going to be you're probably going to get some sort of a letter, you know, investigational. But one thing you alluded to, and I want to go to Matt on this, is, you know, one of the things you alluded to was this premise of resubmitting a claim. And the big issue in resubmitting a claim is you've got to resubmit a claim if you're looking to get paid for a denied claim or an adjusted claim, as they call it, during the 12-month adjudication period, while you can still do it, right? In the Medicare realm, we've talked about this a lot of time, that some of the issues involving some of the fraud out there, particularly in the telefraud cases with DME, genetic testing, and the like, is the fact that you have 12 months to submit a claim. So a provider who is intent on committing fraud will submit that claim for the DME, genetic testing, you know, whatever it may be, as quickly as possible, knowing that that claim is not going to be held up because of prompt pay rules, that you have to pay that claim typically within 14 days. And so what you wind up happening is these situations where the claims never really catch up. So you got that 12-month period where you can mess around and field test claims, deny it. You can resubmit a claim multiple times. But, you know, what that really, you know, if you've had a claim denied, and you're going to get a reason code while it's denied as a provider. But, you know, on the payer side, there are a lot of reasons why providers get their claims denied. And Matt, you see that we see this all the time, right? And so give me, you know, what's sort of your hit list of the common reasons why a claim gets denied? And in some of these, they're getting denied in instances where had the provider just had a good quality assurance program or a good self-auditing program, some of these denials would not occur.
Yeah, a lot of them are just perhaps input errors or data processing errors, where it's they put in the wrong insurance information, or the insurance is in the wrong order. So there's a coordination of benefits problem when it comes to adjudication. They put in the wrong demographics of the patient, the address or date of birth, and that gets denied. So those are just simple mistakes, but it causes questions to be raised and denials to occur and those things. But, you know, one of the things that's, you know, really, you know, and Wade talked about, you know, it's hard to define mistake versus, you know, potential fraud when you're just looking at data from a plan's point of view. For example, sometimes they're putting the wrong rendering physician on the claim. Could be a simple mistake, but in the eyes of the plan, if the same rendering physician is being used because other ones aren't credentialed yet, or the billing service is just using the same one or two just because it's easier to a plan, that's looking like, ooh, impossible days. How could this person right. be in 12 places at the same time, or doing, you know, 15 home visits? And that's raising a red flag of possible fraud when it could be just a billing entry error by the clerk. And the only way to find those things out is either internally through a quality assurance compliance plan, which is the optimal way, or it's going to be through some sort of review or investigation done by the plan, right. where it's going to come down to, you know, the data says this, but the medical records say this. How did this happen? Then going back to that root cause and saying,
right.
oh, it's a mistake. And then it's, okay, how do you rectify that? You know, through education, you know, is there, you know, get an overpayment, whatever it might be, you know, you got to go along that continuum of remedies that, that Wade referenced to rectify those things. But it's hard to determine the difference between the two just based on the data. So
right.
being ultra careful on the front end saves right. a lot of back end mistakes.
And I think, you know, part of where we see some of these problems with misuse or inappropriate use of the rendering. You see this a lot in incident two cases,
yes.
right? Incident two cases in the office where the collaborating or supervising physician isn't there. And people have this unfounded belief that as long as the provider is available, which could be by cell phone, but if you read the incident two provisions, it talks about in the office suite. And by the way, there's caveats to that. For example, in hospital settings, there is no office suite. It's on the hospital campus. So there are all these different carve outs. But, you know, the one that we see pretty often are the instances where it's a group and the group isn't credentialed to submit claims. It's individual providers. Whereas in the Medicare world, which is a little different, Medicare provides a group number and then an individual number. And as providers come into a group, they do an 855R, a reassignment of benefits. And so they say, you know, if me, Wade, and Matt are all in the same group, then the group has a billing NPI number, you know, an entity number for that. And then we have our own individual numbers. And when you submit a claim, we're submitting a claim through the group with one of us as the rendering, but when that claim gets processed, because of the 855R form, it's telling the Medicare program, the MAC in that case, in this case, which submits the, you know, pays the claim, it's telling the MAC that when I do this work, it's paid to the group. It's not paid to me individually. And, but other plans, commercial plans, and maybe even some Medicaid plans, they don't credential. As a group, they credential the individuals or they give them a provider number as an individual, which they link back to a group, but it's the individual. You know, and I worked on something towards the end of my career involving a Medicaid pediatric group where there were 10 doctors in the group, two of which were in network with the payer. The other eight were not. But what was happening was when patients came in, the billing people didn't know what to do. So regardless of who the provider was, they submitted the claim under the rendering for one of the two doctors. It appears that they were actually doing it pretty equally. And we did a review of the records. There was nothing wrong with the records. They were pristine, no upcoding, services rendered, all of that. We did it as a civil monetary penalties case, CMP case, and they wound up having to pay a substantial amount of money back because it was a technical violation. It was for the rendering that wasn't the rendering, which then, as you said, Matt, it gets you into these weird, impossible days where one provider, it looks like they're seeing 100 people. You know, in a day when they're really not, you know, and I know we can have a separate conversation about time versus medical decision making in E&Ms and why that's not an impossible day. But when you've got one provider seeing 100 people, there's clearly something that you're going to look at that's wrong with that. And that was really one of those instances when we talked to the provider and they were ultimately settling. It was through their own stupidity is the only way to describe it. The practice manager had the applications for the payer to get the providers in network sitting on their desk for probably a year and forgot about them. And then they ended up under the pile of papers and menus for lunch and all the other things. And it was really just out of, you know, it was an unintentional error. The people in the billing department didn't know what to do. So they weren't well-trained and didn't ask the right questions. And it ultimately cost that practice a lot of money for failing to do that. But it, you know, it obviously didn't show up as an outlier until it showed up as an outlier. So, you know, as we kind of wrap up, Matt, so just kind of, you know, your final thoughts on this, on the, you know, these mistakes that really do unfortunately can lead to really disastrous financial consequences and other things.
Yeah, it's, you know, be penny wise and pound foolish, you know. You're supposed to have a compliance plan in place or program in place. You have to utilize that. You have to have a quality assurance program. It might cost you a little bit of money and some resources to have someone check those claims to make sure that they are up to snuff that if you're a Medicare provider that you have updated your NPI registry, that you don't have the wrong address in there, because that raises questions. Make sure that you have those things in place when you're submitting your claims, that the information is correct, that it's double checked, because in that way, you're going to avoid a lot of denials, and then you're going to avoid a lot of questions coming up at the end that may cost you more money, because by the time it's discovered, it's become that pattern that looks more like fraud than it does an error.
Right. And that's where being vigilant and having a good compliance program in place. And by the way, it's not just a compliance program. It's what's known as an effective compliance program, because you got to actually use it. It can't just be on a shelf. It can't be a template. It can't be something that you pulled off of the internet in Word and said, hey, this is close enough. I'm a DME supplier. This one is for an internal medicine practice. Close enough, right? It's not the close enough for government work only works for people in the government. It doesn't always work for the provider community. So it's having that effective compliance program and seeing why you're getting those denials, so that things that are just mistakes or errors can be easily corrected. You got to look at those explanation of benefits and understand the reason code. You may not agree with the reason. We're not here to have a debate. You know, we're not here to have roadside justice about whether you should get the ticket or not, right? Like, it's not the time, but we're just saying, like, you're going to get a denial. And if you're looking to appeal the denial because of some technical error, did you put the wrong diagnosis in by mistake, but it still passed muster, or did it get rejected because of an NCCI, an MUE, a plan edit, or something along those lines? Or is there something more to it? Did you transpose a Medicare ID number? Did you, is it Matt Kachansky Jr. versus Senior, and you put in the wrong date of birth, for example? Some of these things that can be corrected, but always keep in mind, you've got that 12-month window and you want to get it done as quickly as possible because you want to make sure you get paid. You don't want to be in a position where you've stalled on getting your claim in. And then you find that, you know, by the time you've done your reconciliation, you're at that 12-month mark. That's why it makes no sense to wait. Submit your claims in a timely manner so that you can get paid. You know, while payers have to submit claims timely, pay claims timely, right? That usually it's a 14-day window unless it's going to be flagged. Providers don't have to make a submission timely. And we've talked, I think, ad nauseum about if there was a timely filing requirement, how we would be able to potentially stop some of the FWA that's out there. But you know, that's another conversation of time. So it is important to understand that, you know, these innocent mistakes or mistakes can become issues. And that's why I think from the vetting process, as an SIU, you've got to have a good understanding of what is this allegation. Is there a pattern of practice from the billing history that shows you that there is a greater problem here than just these one-offs where you might just treat it as an overpayment versus looking to do something where you're making a referral to a Mafuku, the OIG, or something along those lines. So there are these implications of how these mistakes can lead to investigations. And so for providers, get your ducks in a row and you won't have these problems as frequently. You're always going to have problems because it's just not a perfect system. But also on the payer side, understand, is this something that can be resolved through something other than the SIU, which is obviously ties back to all of our conversations about payment integrity being a full service kind of organization and not this bifurcated group of people. So we'll keep looking at this stuff. We'll keep talking about it. Welcome to 2025. Again, we're well into it. And thanks, everybody, for joining. And again, you can catch our weekly OIG roundtables. You can catch it off the newsletter from our website. You can sign up for it. You can get it off of YouTube. You can get it off of Spotify. We've got a great LinkedIn Live coming up in the next week or so. I'm actually going to be spending some time with Gene Stone. If you know who Gene Stone is, we'll be getting on with Gene Stone. And that'll be a great LinkedIn Live. We're going to talk a lot about revisiting a topic that we talked about previously with her a little bit more in depth regarding the senior Medicare patrol. So as always, we appreciate your time. It looks like Matt fell off. He's in a snow belt. Maybe he's losing, you know, he needs Wade to go over and help him. But there he is. He's back. He's back to say goodbye to all of us.
Yes,
we thought
sorry
that
about
you
that.
Got caught in the winter tundra. So you're back perfectly in time to give a wave, and we'll see you on the next OIG roundtable.
Thank you all.
Thank you.